Now, the next slide is kind of small, but you can make it out. And if not, this is the rule. We're about to read a Mishnah. And the Mishnah, you know, is the first, the original Hebrew section of the Talmud that was first authored by, or let us say it was edited, brought all together by Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi about 2,000 years ago. So this Mishnah brings one rule that I've been enjoying for the last 10 days. Okay, and that's going to be the rule that we're going to be looking at tonight. I'm going to try, now that it's 10 minutes to 10, I'm going to try to kind of step it up a little bit. But here is the rule. It starts at Mishnah Gimel, and then it's very small, so you know, take out your microscopes. But it starts right over here where it is a little gimel, and I'll read it and I'll translate it. Gimel. This is the law of Orla. Ilan Shenekar Vahasela Imo. A tree that became uprooted and its rock is with it. What does it mean, its rock? The Rav Bartanura, which is one of the commentaries on the side, means that the rock, and in order not to get the room dirty, is the earth which is connected directly with the root system. And what I'm going to do is, this is a flower pot that I happened to find on the ground as I was walking to a shul one day. And I don't want to, I would like to actually pull it apart, but the fact of the matter is that the root system of this plant is embedded in this part which is called sela. Now, the Hebrew word sela means rock. And it could mean that the earth gets so intertwined with the root system that it becomes hard. It becomes like a rock that if you pull the tree out, the root system pulls out this earth with it. So let's go back to the rule. Ilan shenekar v'hasela imo. A tree that became uprooted with its rock, meaning this earth on its root system. For example, shtafol nahar v'hasela imo. A river came and floated a tree away. A river came and uprooted a tree. Or if a wind came and pulled out a tree. It could also mean, well, I'm not so sure, but I'm going to leave it as a question. Could it also mean if a person actually uprooted the tree? In other words, purposely. But all right, let's not go there just yet. One thing we know for sure, it's talking about a tree that was uprooted with its B-O-L-L, bowl. B-O-L-L. That's the English term for the sela is B-O-L-L, bowl. Now, if you look it up in Google, you know, it's always ball, B-A-L-L. And I sat with Dr. Klein last week, and he says, it's B-O-L-L. And I said, but every time I look on the Google, he says, well, they're wrong. So if you look it up, you look for a tree ball, B-A-L-L, and it talks about the earth around the root system. But the real term, at least according to Dr. Klein, is B-O-L-L. So, so that's the way I believe in Torah Sheba Al Peh. And if a from Jew who's in tree science, like Dr. Klein, tells me it's B-O-L-L, that's good enough for me. I don't care what the internet says. Okay, let's go on with the law. Im yachol lichyot patur. If the tree
if the tree is able to continue to live,
if the tree is able to live in its bowl, in its cella, then patur, you are exempt. Exempt from what?
Waiting another 3 years.
Bingo! You hit it right there. You do not have to turn the clock back. Okay. Ve'im lav, but if the tree cannot live from its bowl, chayav, you are obligated. Okay, which means what do you have to do if a tree can't live from its bowl and then it gets replanted or you replanted it? You got to reset the clock. You got your 3 years already. By the way, yeah.
What's the time limit on how long it has to be before?
How
long does it have to live for in the bowl before it's...
Ding, ding, ding. That's exactly. This is exactly what I said at the beginning. I wanted to take you along on my own journey. That was exactly the question I had. I read this mission for the first time, and I go, for how long? You know, that was the obvious question. For how long? And I looked at every single commentary on the page of the Mishnah, and nobody says how long. So I then took a Talmud Yerushalmi, which has Talmud Gemara, which talks about this. I said, "Oh, the Talmud will talk about it." Nobody gives you like a time range. Nobody gives you a time range. It just says, if it could live, you don't set the clock back. If you don't have to live, if it does, can't live. So then I'm starting going in my mind and saying, well, hold it. How can I construct the case? Nobody is saying that there's a time limit in there. And I'm saying, how can I construct the case in my mind where you don't need a time limit? Yeah, what are you thinking?
Well, we're talking about fruit trees.
Yeah.
So it would seem that if it's able to live enough to provide fruit, then...
A season of fruit. Okay. So that's one... What's your name?
Nothing.
That's a great idea. I just didn't find it written. Okay. I mean, that's a fine idea. That would answer my question, but, like... If Nahum was, you know, lived 500 years ago and he wrote it, then, you know, I'm good, you know. Yeah. What were you going to say? Okay. All right. So, I'm sitting with Dr. Klein last week, and I said to him, you know what drives me nuts about this Mishnah? He goes, yeah, the time range, or the lack of it. I go, yeah! I said, this is like the obvious question. So he says to me, 2 weeks. I said, well, where did you get that from? I said, he sends me a citation, which is, if you take a look on page 4 and 5, the bottom slide of 4 and the top slide of 5, believe me, if you want me, I'm happy to send you an email. This is only an excerpt of the entire citation, which discusses the opinions of how long this tree needs to live. Actually, it turns out that there's 3 basic opinions. One opinion is it has to live for another 3 years. But the problem that I have is, well, hold it. Are you supposed to estimate now that it will live for 3 years? Because if you're telling me that you got to wait for 3 years to test it, well then, what am I supposed to do with the fruit during those 3 years of the testing? Eat them or throw them out? Okay, that's the first opinion. So I don't understand what to do with that opinion.
Well, isn't it still in the same counting cycle?
So let's go back to what that Mishnah said. You first have to make an estimate. You have to take a look at the tree and its bowl, and somebody, like Dan here, or somebody, has got to make an estimate saying, oh yeah, that tree can live X. You know, in other words, and then some rub has to say, okay, you think you're going to live for another 3 years?
Can you eat?
You know? Because what good does it do you? What good does the Mishnah do you if it says you gotta wait, if it can live, and you gotta wait 3 years to test it? Well, heck, if you gotta wait for 3 years to test it, don't just say that you gotta make the fruit no good. So the estimate has to be at the very beginning. Another opinion is, yeah.
It would seem like it doesn't matter the time limit, because each tree would be different. Some trees, the roots grow faster in the beginning and then slow down. Some trees, you have to wait, and I don't know.
And by the way, it is true. It's different from tree to tree. There is an average of fruit trees, basically olive trees and fruit trees in Israel. Okay. But one thing I was wondering as to whether this has anything to do with changing the tree phase. Like, when a tree comes, it becomes unplanted. Does it suddenly go back into juvenility again? Is the Mishnah trying to say as well, if it can live for 3 years in its bulb, then it's not going to, then whatever, if it's already at the reproductive phase, which it should be already because it's past 3 years, it won't go back into the juvenile phase. But if it can't live from its bulb, it'll go back. So at first, I thought, well, what? No, if a tree gets into reproductive time, it should stay in reproductive time. So I asked Dr. Klein. He goes, he says, that's not true. And he says, there's a thing which is called shock. He says, just like it happens to a human being, there's stress and there's shock. When a tree becomes uprooted, remember, the tree is a living thing. And in many ways, it's human. He says, so don't automate. He wasn't saying that I was wrong. He was just saying is, don't discount the possibility that when a tree becomes uprooted, it becomes unproductive. You send it into a shock and stress situation. And by the way, I just learned a halacha this last Shabbos. Just learned a halacha. And I mean, Dan knows what I'm telling you. He knows what I'm telling you about. Is that on some, that the halacha talks about, like during Shemitah year, are you allowed to cut certain roots of trees? What was the purpose? What was the purpose of cutting certain roots, or certain branches, certain roots? Because they would come back thicker. If you cut them off, it would come back thicker. Because what you're doing is you're causing a shock, and in order to get off over the shock, the tree sends more nutrients to that spot, the spot of the cut, and it actually thickens the root.
So you lift the tree out of its, out of the earth, trim the root, and put it back in the earth?
I don't know how it's done. Dan can tell you how it's done. Okay. How is that done? How do people,
if we're talking about bonsai,
it's a long talk.
It's a long discussion.
It's a long discussion.
In every case, if he had to move.
Right.
So, but it's just the same concept as pruning, though.
Yeah, generally root pruning is not done in hardly any circumstance, unless a person is trying to achieve, you know, bonsai effect, or is trying to keep the tree with a small, compact root system and keep its canopy larger, for example, in growers' operations and garden centers for sale.
All right, yeah, thank you. Taking that, we'll go on. Yeah, nothing. What were you about to say? Because we'll keep treading along. Yeah, go ahead.
Well, it seems like another factor that somebody would have to take into consideration is where you're going to be planting. Because to know whether or not the tree is going to live for another 3 years, especially if we're talking about shock, what happens if the tree was used to a certain type of soil and certain nutrients in the soil, or was used to shade on the north side of it, and now it's getting no shade, or shade just on the left side?
You're absolutely right. If you read through the entire citation, which we're not going to do tonight, what the Rabbanan, we're talking about the Rashba, who lived 700 years ago, 800 years ago, and all the way down they bring the Rosh, who also lived 800-900 years ago, down to Rav Moshe Feinstein and Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach, who just lived, you know, not too long ago. Many different ideas were brought up. What does it mean if it can live? I had an idea. My idea was, what if you took it and potted it? Okay. And, you know, would it be big enough to be able to live for 3 years if you potted it? The point is, That's not what the Mishnah is talking about. And the second opinion we said, so we said the first three opinion was 3 years. The second opinion was just a few days. As long as it just lives for a few days. That's the second opinion. A third opinion is the concept of 2 weeks. Because generally we find by other trees in the Mishnah that the concept of taking root under Jewish law is generally considered 2 weeks. Two weeks. Now, according to Dr. Klein, that could very well be true scientifically. Okay, but we find so many of the poskim, like Rav Moshe and Rav Albas, said if it could live for about 2 weeks. But I find it most astounding is that that's not written in the what's called the Rishonim. It's not found in the classics. That's more of a modern psak halakha. Well, what are the ramifications? What are the ramifications for today? Yeah.
Anyone mention watering in
this? I think that's presumed. Yeah, in other words, if it can live
with water.
Yeah, in other words, okay. And then another thing occurred to me just this last Shabbat. Another thing, you know, now if you take a look through this whole citation, they're discussing the concept of, well, what if you took it and instead of replanting it, in other words, putting it into a hole and putting more dirt around it, you just took it and dug a hole and just put it into the hole, could it live that way? That was one of the suggested answers. Yeah.
This might open up a whole can of worms, but like a hydroponic.
Worms are good. They bring nutrients. Yeah,
yeah,
okay.
Hydroponics, where there is no soil.
Yeah.
You're just...
That's a good point. I would say let's stay clear of that right now because it just mixes in a variable. We're not even clear about the earth variable.
Right.
You're absolutely right. another thing that... Yeah, what, were you about to say something?
You know, like shrubs, like you said, the blue...
No, no, this gentleman right here. Yeah, go ahead. Shrubs. Back to shrubs.
So you don't have to wait for like a blueberry bush 3 years or something.
If it's a perennial, generally if it's considered a perennial tree, then you would have to wait the 3 years. So I mean I'm not a tree scientist, so you have to find out which one's a perennial and what's an annual.
I didn't understand well the thing of cutting the one of the roots. I'm trying to make the comparison.
Yeah, yeah.
With human life, you know, when because we have roots.
Yeah.
Also, so it's like in Torah, everything have a spiritual meaning.
What we can get into spirituality.
No, but I wanted to understand it's you are allowed to cut. Roots, right?
Yeah.
But certain roots, you told.
Well, I said that as a side thing having to do with, there's a rule called the Shemitah here, the year of Shabbat, where
yes.
you're not supposed to work the ground. So they just wanted to know whether trimming roots was considered a work on this Shabbat or not.
Okay, so they defined special roots?
Yeah, yeah. No, not specific roots.
Not specific.
But, yeah, let's go on from there. What just occurred to me this last Shabbat, and it turns out that this is what the Rambam was talking about, which actually messes up. I don't want to get into it. Like I said, I'm not a halacha man. He explains this Mishnah is that the tree was uprooted by mistake. The tree was uprooted by a snake, so the way you imagine it, according to the Rambam, is that the tree was uprooted by a wind or by water, and it was just thrown into another place, and it landed in another place. And the only question is, can it live in the next place without you doing anything, just like it lived over there? That's the whole question. How does it have practical application for today?
We move trees a lot.
Right! What I'm saying is that according to the strict reading of the Rambam, if you move a tree on purpose, you always have to move the clock back to zero. That it only, this rule of the Mishnah only becomes operative when the tree was uprooted
by a natural disaster of some sort.
So then going back to the tree that's 2 years old, and
in practice... Well, but that's not what's done in practice. In practice, this Mishnah is even applied to saplings. And that, yeah.
Do we paskin according to the Rambam on that?
There is, no. There is some controversy. The issue comes up with moving saplings from the nursery to the consumer. The general rule, which is that was explained to me by Mr. Kirschenbaum. Now we're off of Dr. Klein for a while. Now, Mr. Kirschenbaum, who I spoke to, is a third generation orchard owner. And he's also a religious Jew. And he purchases saplings. And he uses, if you take a look, and by the way, I'm not going to spend a lot of time, you can take a look at it yourself. What makes a good tree bowl? If you take a look on page... all the slides on page 3. All the slides on page 3. And the first two slides on page 4. Those... And enjoy this. You can take this, you know, back to your school and look at those. What is the concept of a good tree bowl, which keeps something alive? I only put that in, you know, just to be. I'm not going to call it filler, but you know, just you know, so that you could have something to read. Because I wanted to know what makes a good tree bowl. You know, how does it have to? You know, how far does the root system go out? Dr. Klein said to me. He says that generally a root system extends out as far as the crown. In other words, if you have a tree and the crown is how far the branches extend, he says generally the root system underneath the ground goes out as far as the crown of the tree.
That's a Gemara, guys.
And that, okay. I didn't know that, but it's confirmed by... The Gemara, which knew it before, is confirmed by the sign. Okay. All right. I'm going to start to close because because we are getting into to the 11th hour here. These bags, which have little holes in them, if you notice, you want to pass this bag around, which has holes.
Yeah.
Saplings.
It's a holy bag.
H-O-L-Y. Saplings are transferred from the nursery to the orchard in bags with holes. The idea being that more than the transportation, the saplings are actually held in these bags at the nursery in order so that the plant should be considered touching the ground. Okay. And therefore, in other words, if these saplings are sitting in these bags for a while, it's not considered as if they've been unplanted, such that when they're repurchased and they're planted, you put the clock back.
They're sitting on earth when they're in the bag?
Yeah, in other words, they take that. There is a...
Can I explain?
Yeah, sure, go ahead.
Halachically, we had a guy in Kochav Yaakov bought 5 trees. Those trees were in a closed bag, and they grew there with the sela, a closed bag. Halachically, that tree is not considered like it grew in the ground. We have a concept of a atzitz noku, that a flower pot has to have a hole, the size that a root can go through. That's the holes you're seeing here. We have a machlokas, Rashi Tosfos, which applies to many halachot, where the Gemara basically says that an earthenware pot can transfer nutrients even without a hole in it. And a metal pot doesn't transfer unless you really have a hole. And then the question is, the range in between. Are most objects like earthenware or are most objects like metal? And that's a big machlokas. Now this is relevant even on Shabbos. Because if you have a plant sitting on the ground and there's a hole in the vase or an earthenware pot, you're going to lift that pot and put it on a table. So halacha considers it as though you severed it from its source of nutrients. So these holes are critical because if you didn't have these holes, then we are uncertain how to treat plastic, and we would assume that the tree grew
not in the ground, grew hydroponically, and the three-year count didn't begin. So my poor neighbor, who bought five trees and planted them, and they were all enclosed plastic bags, had to start the count from scratch.
And right, and these saplings, before they were put in the bag, already, as I said before, they were already planted in such a way that halakhically, 2 years were already accounted for. So to put them into a closed bag and then replant them, you have to set the clock back.
So the second it touched the closed bag, that ruined it.
Could be, yeah, could be.
Okay,
yeah.
But when they're in an open bag like are they sitting on top of the
ground? He keeps them on the ground.
So as long as they're on the ground, it's considered...
Right, and then the transportation itself... The transportation itself
counts as the bowl.
It's like this Mishnah is moving from place to place. Yeah. What's your name?
Yaakov.
Yeah.
I'm confused why putting
Go ahead.
I'm confused why putting it from being you take the ball out of the earth, you uproot the plant, and then you put it in a plastic bag without holes. Why would that start the clock over they can live?
Right. The idea is that by putting it into a closed bag, it's a mind thing. It's you're by doing that, you are indicating with your mind that you're separating it from the ground. It becomes a cerebral type of thing. In other words, if you take a tree out, and your intention is to plant it right away, or if it comes out by itself and it gets replanted right away, the question is, it's a mind thing. When is there an intention for it to be considered separated from the ground? So the halakha says, okay, we do understand that you intend to replant it. But if you put it into a container which doesn't allow it to be part of the ground. Now you're saying it can still live from its bowl. And by the way, maybe there is a way to gauge that. You don't really have to check that if you have your holes in the bag. Which, by the way, there's your answer right there. That as long as you have holes in the bag, you don't have to be so concerned about the size of the bowl. Do you see what I'm saying?
Could even uproot it with no dirt.
Right, as long as you have the holes in the bed. Right.
Well,
you got it.
That doesn't mean anything. Then certainly, if you had a lot of bowl, then it shouldn't matter.
Yeah, so if you have a lot of bowl, then it could very well be that if you have no holes in your bed, you're still good.
So theoretically...
Yes.
All you would have to do with a bag is just poke a few holes in it and...
Yeah, they have to be the right... There's a certain diameter that they have to be. There has to be a couple of centimeters. It's the halakha gives a certain diameter of a weaving pin which had a couple of centimeters width to it. I mean, you know, okay, whatever. All right, let's go on. But that was a good distinction and a good point. Yeah. The reason when they use these bags with the holes makes it less necessary to gauge the size of the bowl. But if the bowl was big enough, then you might not even need a band at all. Okay, good point. Thank you. All right. Let's, by the way, the last, the slides on page 6, 7, and 8 are just these are just slides provided to me by Mr. Kirschenbaum about, he's just showing you the various samplings that he has in these bags, and he makes sure that they have holes in them, etc. Okay. One last thing that I want to go over with you, which is actually just a side point, and I'll just say it quickly because I know that we do want to close for the evening, is when I was talking to Dr. Klein, he discussed a type of spray which is called Dilwet. And the slides are on page 5 and 6.
Apple.
What?
Oh, and the apple.
Yeah. Okay. Now, what Dilwet does is it's basically a sophisticated soap. What you spray the Dilwet on a tree, on a branch.
It's a Dilwet.
It's a type of spray of a chemical. He called it a sophisticated soap. That's what when I said, what is it? He goes, well, I'll just say it's a sophisticated soap. I said, okay, what do you do with it? He says when the buds are starting to flower and there's flowering, you spray it on, and then it kills the buds. Okay, not the bugs, the buds. In other words, it makes it so the fruit doesn't grow. Okay. Okay, he says it has two applications. Okay,
if you take a look at the first, on page 5. Why would you do it?
Trying to prevent the fruit from growing and falling to the ground and attracting the.
During the oral years, you want to minimize, since if the farmer is an Orthodox, you know, is an observant Jew. Okay, he wants to keep the forbidden fruit as minimal as possible. First of all, less to destroy, less to clean up, less of a chance that some of it will get to market by mistake. Okay, so that's one application. He says the second application is during the years of non-orla, during the years where the fruit is actually permitted. He says that much of the fruit which is produced actually gets thrown out because there's an overabundance. You can't sell it all. He says a lot of farmers are throwing out. He was telling me, he showed me pictures of baskets and baskets of etrogin that were just thrown out. I said, oh, are those the cheap ones that you can get on air every other? He says, no, these don't even get to the market in the first place. They're thrown out.
You think they just plant less trees?
That's what you would think.
It's a hard thing to control.
Right. So he uses the dill wet because, remember, if you have on one branch 10 fruit, all those 10 fruit are all demanding the finite nutrients which are in that branch.
That's a pruning method.
Correct. That's correct. And therefore, the fruit which is produced that doesn't get killed by the dillet is generally larger fruit, which has greater revenue value in the long run to the farmer.
So what halakhic implications does dillet have? Anything?
No, just the implications with the orla.
The reason they use it, you're saying?
That's right, correct.
Is that safe for the tree?
Yeah,
prevents pollination.
Yeah. Gentlemen, I hope you know, we could spend a lot of time in this. I really appreciate that there was a lot of, we were able to get it out of the lecture mode and get it more into the discussion mode. I really appreciate that. I was very excited about this, and I'm praying that you have more questions, unanswered questions, and I'll keep you, I'll keep you in the know in terms of any new things that are coming up. I just want to go over the spelling of anybody who wrote down their names on that. I'd like to just go over the spelling of your emails just to make sure that I understand them. And I want to thank you. I hope you enjoyed that this was a worthwhile use of your time. Yes, thank you. Thank you.
Your pamphlets.
Oh, party!
We brought
some English. Welcome. Did we gain something?
Yeah.
Okay. Good. That's the main thing I'm concerned about, is that we actually used our time and gained something.
I have some questions. Most of them were asked by.
Oh, okay.
Oh, you're right.
So,
An in-depth look at what we did last time.
This is nice. So about the orla flies outside.
Where's the button? Is there? Oh, here's power.
And I also what about this?
All right, so let's.
Okay, Akiva, I need you to bring the extras back. They're listening. I asked for a few extras. I figured you would want one in the office and the library. Okay.
Yes, sir.
So I'll just provide. Go to the bank. So yes. We have extra pizza, which you can decide who behaves nicest in Madrid. This is virtual.
No. Divide it up with the guys, okay?